You're listening to The Edie J. Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Shalom, amigos. Welcome to The Edie J. Adler Show. Oddly enough, I am Edie J. Adler. Thank you for tuning in. This show is dedicated to everyone. Every topic is allowed as long as we keep it civil. No name calling, no insults. This is not the show for you if you are used to that. Also, I want to remind you that I am a strong supporter of Israel. And I am grateful for this beautiful country, the United States of America. That said, I want to welcome my guest this week, Todd Rubenstein. He's a valued member of my congregation, and I'm very grateful that he accepted my invitation to come to the show. Welcome, Todd. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. You're very welcome. And I'm delighted you asked.
So why don't we tell our listeners a little bit about you?
Okay. I'd like to say, actually, I like the intro with the Shalom Amigos. You went to two different languages, and I thought that was very interesting.
I've been doing that for a lot of years.
Okay. Right. So, yeah, I got a real storied past. You know, basically my occupation is an attorney. Licensed by the bar in 1994. Struggled to get there, then became a DA for the County of Los Angeles. I was very fortunate to have worked under the Garcetti administration during a very auspicious time, as they say. We just come out of the Rodney King riots. I was a law clerk at the time. And then once I became a DA in 94, we were in the middle of prosecuting the trial of the century with O.J. And so while I wasn't directly involved, I had worked with the people who were involved, Bill Hodgman, Marsha Clark. I didn't know Chris Darden to save my life, but I worked with these people. They were the salt of the earth. And I think the process changed a lot of people, including Judge Ito at the time, as well as Marsha. And, of course, we know how that trial ended.
I always thought they were putting on a show, the judge, Marsha. I may be wrong, but because there were cameras allowed during that trial, I think that they were putting on a show and not really doing their job the way they should have been doing it.
Yeah, a lot of people would agree with you. In fact, the defense team from F. Lee Bailey to Robert Shapiro to Johnny Cochran, there were a few others as well, but those were the principal participants. I mean, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. I mean, that's the classic putting on a show style. The inside baseball is very fascinating. Real quickly, that case should have never been downtown.
I agree.
And if it were transferred downtown, it should have started in Santa Monica, picked the jury in Santa Monica, and sent it downtown. The jury that they picked was more of what I would call a Compton jury than a downtown jury. So a lot of people don't understand that downtown is very mixed. You could get two Hispanics, a couple blacks, a few Asians, a few whites, very mixed crowd downtown at the criminal courts building. Compton, though, is way different. It's predominantly Hispanic and predominantly black. The jury was, I think it was probably eight blacks, four Hispanics, or maybe nine blacks. It was just really, it was a really poorly assembled jury and not really representative of not only the community, but O.J. Simpson's peers.
Yeah, so, and absolutely fans of his.
Right.
And I didn't like when they took him to see his house. That was a circus. And yeah. I'm not a lawyer, but to me, I was banging my head and saying to myself, what the heck are they thinking?
Right. Well, it's a shame that O.J. never found the real killer, because once he was acquitted, you know, he promised that he would go find the real killer. And, may he rest in peace, but I don't think he tried very hard.
Oh, well, I think he did find him the first time he looked in the mirror.
Okay. That's probably true. So, yeah, I've been doing this for 30-plus years all over the county. Now I've been doing defense work since the late 90s, predominantly criminal defense. I do cherry-pick my cases. So what I had to do was I peeled off a little bit more practice area, so to speak, family law, which I call all the uncharged crimes. A little bit of real estate law, which I really enjoy, more transactional than litigation. I do solve a lot of problems with residential buyers every once in a while, the commercial transaction. But that's what I've been doing for, you know, the last 25 years. I had done a lot of real estate investment, both residential and some commercial. But in this particular environment where the valuations are so high and the lending rates are not all that favorable.
Especially in California.
Right. And the lending rates are not favorable. So to get the returns now required of the wheelhouse that I, you know, the area in which I was practicing, which is predominantly mom and pop, you've got to offer 9.5, 10.5, or upwards of 12% return on equity. And when you're paying, you know, 6 or 7% on your first loan on whatever property is, whether it's multifamily or otherwise, it just gets hard to generate those returns.
I understand. Yeah, as you know, I'm married to a realtor.
Yeah.
Neil Adler. By the way, if you guys need a good realtor, honest, really honest,
competent,
get a hold of him with over 30 years experience too. NeilAdler.com. That's my plug for my honey.
Nice. That's your plug.
Yes. So thank you. I wanted to invite you because I'm fascinated by law. Like I said, I'm not a lawyer, but my mother used to tell me, you should have been a lawyer. No one can win an argument with you. But given the situation that we're living in Los Angeles, well, with criminals seem to have more rights than the victims. I wanted to maybe you can walk me through that. And why is that? Why has it changed so much? Because I remember when my parents brought me here, things were so different. It was the late 80s, I mean 70s. And everything was so different. People were respectful. People didn't start name-calling. And you were afraid to do something wrong because you knew you would go to jail. And now, what is this thing that you can steal up to $900, $1,200, and it's okay? It's not okay. Stealing is stealing, whether you steal a penny or you steal a house, which also happens. So what has changed? What is wrong with the system?
Well, you asked me a question for the ages, and it's really a symptom of something we see nationwide. And we see it predominantly where you've got massive power and control in what now is what we call the left, okay? And many commentators will distinguish between the leftist and the liberal. Unfortunately, the classical liberal, let's say Alan Dershowitz or Dave Rubin, who left the left, these people who were very similar to, quote, conservatives, they just differed on, let's say, the size of government.
Right.
They all believed in free speech. The problem with the liberal is they enable the left. The left is fantastic and outstanding at demonizing the right, okay? And they've been doing that for 150-plus years. And, you know, Jews especially, which is a kind of an interesting, along with blacks, they're still waiting for FDR to come back. And why, I don't even know. That's a whole nother discussion. But what's really happened is you've got so many things going on, Edie. You got the death of God, okay, which started in the early 60s with the Vitale case where you could not say a prayer for your teacher because that was offensive to the atheists who did not want to pray to God or even say the Pledge of Allegiance, for God's sakes. And then it just slowly and gradually moved from there. The feminist movement was completely destructive to our society and to women. You know, it's really interesting that, you know, my whole life growing up, I was raised in a broken family in Phoenix. We had a father here in L.A., and I got into a lot of trouble as a kid. But I was always told by women that they were the superior sex. Now, of course, as a kid, I never believed that. I didn't believe that men were superior. I just thought it was just a boast by a lot of the girls in my orbit or the women. And no one ever explained why. Now, I think as I've grown up, you know, I'm in my late 50s and have accumulated a lot of wisdom, hopefully, and knowledge and experience and expertise. Men and women have their own strengths, right?
I agree.
Yeah. So they, you know, men might be good at one thing and bad at another, and women compliment men with one thing and another. You can't say that in polite company. I do, because I'm an independent operator. I'm not beholden to anybody. You know, my wife, we share values, you know, 95%. We don't agree on everything. But I think that's what makes for a reasonably happy union. But our society has experienced the death of God. The Marxists have gained so much, not only power, but this moral authority, if you can call it that. I mean, I don't think I'd really say that. I'd say authority, or they've convinced a whole generation or two that they are the compassionate ones.
And everybody else is a victim.
Correct. And so what happens is, especially in these blue cities, you just get this chaos. You just get this total disorder. And if you don't have the grounding of God, for example, and I wasn't raised with anything. I mean, yes, I'm part of the congregation now, and I do read Torah, and, you know, I helped lead the service, you know, last week with you and the other women. So I've gotten really involved over the last decade. But before that, I had nothing. Even though I was what I call a gyno, right, Jew in name only, I for some reason had this sense of equity. The left has ruined the word, but I used to say equity for the last 30-plus years. And that's kind of a sense of fairness. It's like this internal thing where, you know things are wrong. And even though I used to be a juvenile delinquent, you know, a JD is used to be, you know, they used to call me a Jewish delinquent, but it's really a juvenile delinquent. Mm-hmm. I had a problem with theft and all kinds of other things. And I finally learned in my teens, you know, a lot of things that I did were wrong, you know, and I paid the price for them. But I learned from it. I didn't see myself as a victim. I learned from it, and I decided, if I can't beat the police or the court system, I might as well join them. That's kind of how I got my start. But to your question, if you don't have the grounding of, let's say, a higher power, and you don't have that meaning, you're going to look to something else. Everybody needs meaning, probably more than they need food. And you could just see it in the environmental movement. I mean, what greater meaning can you get than saving the planet? I mean, that's the ultimate.
Right.
Right?
And I love the planet. I love nature. But in my personal humble opinion, that's quite arrogant.
Right.
When you think that you're the one who's going to save the planet.
Correct. But that's how these people get their meaning. And people get, you know, most of the church community, most of the synagogue community gets their meaning by their families, their communities, their praying on their Shabbat or praying on their Sunday. During my travels, I went to hundreds of churches. I sold Bibles and books door to door while I was in college. So I really had a very interesting as well as a sordid past. The other thing is, if you don't have God, there's another thing that the Marxists did extremely well, and they have been attempting to destroy the nuclear family for 50 or 60 years now. And they're really starting to see the fruits of that now. And so if you destroy the nuclear family, right, and you remove the parents, whether it's the dad or both the mom and the dad, or now maybe it's two dads, maybe it's two moms, That's a whole other issue because a lot of these really thoughtful people are thinking like, ooh, we're two dads, but we don't have a, quote, female influence. That's what these people tell me privately. Oh, two lesbian mothers. You know, they do all kinds of interesting things. You know, one mother will have one child, birth one child with a sperm donor, and then the other mother will birth another child with a sperm donor, and they get these kids that are, quote, they're from their bloodline, let's say. And the kids seem to be fairly well adjusted, but they say to me privately, you know, we didn't think about the fact that our kids don't have a male influence.
Right.
And so we try to get relatives or friends, you know. And it's fascinating. On one hand, a lot of the liberal or the leftist will say gender doesn't matter. But then privately, they say, we think these kids need two different sexes to
you
grow
know,
up. You know what I'm saying?
Going back to the equality issue, my father used to always say equal, but not the same. Everybody were equal in the eyes of God. But everybody brings something to the table, something different.
Right.
And I grew up, my mother raised me to be a lady. Going back to the feminist movement, frankly, I think they ruined it for women because now men won't open the door for you and some women get offended.
Won't light your cigarette.
won't pull the chair out for you. My husband does all of that. My father did that for my mother, and he taught my brothers to do that also for women. And he also, I remember I was, the youngest when I was born was 14 years old, so I'm far, far away from my siblings. But I remember my father telling my brothers, you don't ever, ever touch a woman in anger, not even with a petal of a rose.
Ooh, I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I don't know if he came up with that, but that was very, it's ingrained in me. So I would not let a man do that to me. I don't understand women who do that. But the lesson that he was teaching my brothers was how to treat women with respect, with dignity. And yes, I guess some women couldn't vote or whatever. You didn't have to take it so far away as to say a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle.
Right.
Well, maybe it's a bicycling fish.
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting because women started voting over 100 years ago. And what's interesting about this country, just on a side note, I like to throw these little things out. You know, the left likes to tell us that this is a racist country. It's systemically racist. Obama stated that, you know, racism is in the DNA of America. And I'm not offended easily, but that angered me to no end. Because first off, how does he know? And from where does he get that information? It's all baloney.
He was raised by whites.
Right. He was raised by a white mother. And by the way, in the Jewish religion, right, if you are born of a Jewish mother, you're technically Jewish. So if he's born of a white mother, why isn't he white?
Right.
That's just something to think about. But this country's so racist that they actually gave black men the right to vote 50 years before they gave white women the right to vote. Well, all women the right to vote. That's just an anecdote that, you know, your audience can kind of resonate on. But getting back to your question, you know, for me, it's really, really super clear what's going on. And I'm fortunate that I'm in the system. So I was in the system starting at 11 years old when I was arrested for arson. I'm sorry. Attempted burglary and arson at 12. And I got my rear end handed to me by the system, and I had to make a decision. You know, am I going to fix myself because I didn't have a father in the home, or am I going to continue down this road? And there was other influences as well, substances and whatnot. But I was able to extract myself. And a lot of people say to me, how did you do that? Well, for years, I just thought maybe I was lucky. Maybe it was God or me. But I think really what it was about was when you're thrown to the wolves, you'll either eat or be eaten. You'll be killed or be killed. You know what I'm saying? You'll either sink or swim. But what I did was I was bounced back and forth between L.A. and Phoenix a couple of times, and I ended up back in L.A. permanently at 15, which essentially was 1980. Now, when I got to L.A., I also had an opportunity to meet a lot of different friends. All my friends turned out to be from homes where the parents were married, still married, and together. Whereas in Phoenix, when I was in the townhouses, nearly everybody I associated with were latchkey kids. Mm-hmm. Mostly single mothers, like my household. So I got to look at all of my peers' families, and I got to see what they did right, what they did wrong, what was different about my upbringing. And so it was kind of a two-year window, maybe three-year window, into looking at everybody and what they were doing right and what they were not doing right. And it was just a very clear time for me. So that kind of helped me along the path. Today, there's all these different pathologies from lack of God, lack of nuclear family. We know that 75% of black kids, for example, are born out of wedlock now, when in the 40s and the 50s, it was reversed.
Right.
It was reversed. You know, people don't want to address these problems. You know, when I went door to door, I visited thousands of people, both black and white. And the thing that I found in common between blacks and whites and their values were all the same. You know, if you were from a single mother household or a mother and a father in the household and they had great values, the kids typically turned out pretty good. If the mother was too busy doing drugs or having babies and let the kids loose and there was no real structure, then a lot of the boys and some of the girls got into problems. And today, through the feminist movement, in my opinion, you see, you know, like remember in the old days, you were talking about your father and your mother and how they brought you and your siblings up. Back in the 70s, let's say, you really didn't see a lot of the drivers in L.A. so pathological, right?
Right.
I mean, there was traffic, but there's still a lot of common courtesy. Then you got to the point where you start to see a little bit of road rage, but it was typically men. Now, women decided that they're going to compete with men, and they're jerks on the road too. And it's shocking. Really, it's like, how did this happen? And I think it was a progression of the things that I've stated. And it's this entitlement mentality, this narcissism, coupled with this I want it now mentality with social media, I think is a problem. I think it's become a big, big problem for people, not only addictive, but in terms of...
It's pretty anonymous sometimes. They feel the freedom to just go off on people and insult, and it's horrendous.
Well, that's true, 100%. But I was also thinking of like maybe Instagram or even Facebook, where people are so narcissistic that they will do things to get the clicks, do things to get the viewers, do things to get the followers. And I'm not a big follower of this stuff. I'm not it doesn't turn me on, and I don't like it because I know the pathology. But these people think that people care what they're actually doing. You know, they're in their car videoing and they're pontificating on something. Every once in a while, you know, 1 out of 100, maybe something goes viral and it'll be interesting. But everybody's competing with everybody to try to get up the food chain of me, me, me.
Right.
And so it's a very self-centered situation. And so all these little factors play into it. And when you get people in power who are on the left, and again, it's really hard to psychoanalyze them because I'm not in their heads. You kind of have to anecdotally figure it out. But they have a couple of things going on. One is they've been taught that the white Christian male or white people in general are the problem and the only way to fix the system. And it doesn't matter if you look white like George Gascon. I mean, he may claim to be Hispanic, but I'm probably more of color than he is. Okay, and I'm from Eastern Europe, okay? But even self-loathing, quote, white people or whatever will bend because they're cowardly to this monolithic social justice machinery, And what they feel is that these particular criminals are downtrodden by society, right? Poverty causes crime, when we know that's false. It's values. Because how is it that so many poor people don't steal? How is it that so many poor people don't murder? I mean, it's like when you get these school shootings, which is that's another pathology, and we've seen an increase since the late 90s of this stuff. The first thing people say is, oh, they must have been mentally deranged.
I have an anecdote for you.
Yeah.
And my grandmother used to tell me. My grandmother used to teach me by telling me stories. This one was real. It happened when she was little, growing up in a small town in the state of Guerrero in Mexico. Apparently, this guy who was not of the town came to do some business, whatever, and he had a little bag full of gold coins because he had just sold his cattle and he was going to do something else with it. I don't remember the story fully, all the details. But the gist of the story is that he sat down at somebody's door because he was tired and he was wiping his forehead, whatever, and then he left and he forgot his money. Hmm. And he was so distraught and so desperate, and he went to the priest, the rabbi, and asking, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't even have enough money to go home now. All my money was all my investments. I just sold my cattle. And what's going to happen? So a crowd gathered around him. And I don't know. And somebody said, don't worry. You know, somebody, if they find it, they'll return it. Who's going to return that much money? Who's going to return this much money? All of a sudden, this little old lady with raggedy clothes and no shoes. This is how poor she was. And she goes, is this what you were looking for, sir?
Wow.
So,
Did she find it or take it?
No, she found it and then gave it back to the guy. And the guy was beside himself. He couldn't believe that somebody would return that.
Yeah.
And the woman wouldn't even take any money from him. He wanted to give her a reward, and she refused.
Well, that's magnanimous. I think I probably would have taken a few shekels.
Yeah, but the point is that you're right. Poverty does not cause crime. It's your moral compass and your upbringing.
Right.
And if you're accountable to somebody other than yourself.
Well, you know, it is fascinating that people of LA County voted in this particular prosecutor, kind of knowing his background. It's not like he was an unknown. You know, it's not like Kamala Harris, where to the nation, she's really kind of unknown. I mean, to California, she's pretty known. But
they're still going to vote for her, though.
Some people are. Some people are. But that's a whole nother topic. That's a whole nother fascinating conversation, because how do you really vote for somebody who doesn't really stand for anything, is not telling you what she's going to do, but yet she affirmed all the policies of the last 3.5 to 4 years? I don't know why that's so hard, but I guess it's because we have so many people in our country who want to like the person they're voting for as opposed to what their policies are.
Exactly.
So for me, it's always been clear. Now, for me, it was easy. Reagan was a very likable person. Even though they vilified him, it was an easy vote for me. Well, in 1980, I couldn't vote, but I tried to. I couldn't. It's true. I actually was a Reagan fan in 1980. I mean, I was actually a Reagan fan in 1976, but very, very tertiary and very peripherally. Why? Because I was 11 and I didn't really know much, but it was the whole Ford-Reagan primary problem, and then Carter got in. And I was a young Republican from the outset, because, again, when you're thrown to the wolves, then you look back at the entire family that are Democrats that are hysterical and breathing on you with their hysterics. And you look at someone like Reagan and say, well, who is he with? Oh, he's with that crappy party called the Republicans. Well, I'm one of those because he looked to be sane.
Yeah.
And then the more they vilified him, the more, for me at least, it was super simple that it said more about the people that were criticizing him than about him. So, like, he's supposed to start World War III, but how do they know that? See, that's the interesting thing that the left does. The left always says the right is going to do something, right? We on the right typically say the left has already done something.
Correct.
Right? You know what I'm saying? And the left always projects onto the right what they're actually doing. You know, threat to democracy, you know, authoritarian, totalitarian, you name it. I mean, remember, Reagan was supposed to start a theocracy.
I'm very proud to say that the first time I was able to vote was for his second term, and I voted for him.
So in 1984?
Along with my parents. Have you seen the movie, Reagan?
No, I'm ashamed to say I should have run out and saw it, but I intend to see it.
I highly recommend it. You're going to be in tears.
Yeah, Quaid is great, and I've heard a lot about it. And, of course, I mean, I know his story. I know I'm probably going to learn a couple of things, but, you know, I've been a Reaganite for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And so
I was raised Republican.
Okay.
Yeah. Before we continue, I want to, every show I try to feature a pet, a dog, who needs a home. And this week we're going to talk about Kendra. Kendra is a sweet 12-year-old who was in the East Valley shelter in 2020 and adopted a couple of times over the years. People, again, I'm going to say this until the day I die. When you adopt an animal, it's for life. Please, if you're going to adopt a pet, make sure that you're ready for that commitment and don't go returning your dogs. We had a dog. We were on the Cesar Millan show. That's how bad our dog was. I did not return him. We fixed him. We worked with him. So anyway, Kendra was surrendered to the South LA Chesterfield Square a couple of weeks ago. Kendra is one of the sweetest and gentlest dogs, and to know that she is back in the most overcrowded shelters is devastating. So please reach out. Go meet Kendra. Go to your local shelter and save a life. And if Kendra is not the dog for you, I'm sure you will find something. I always do. So I'm not allowed to go to the shelters anymore. So if you want to meet Kendra, the address is 1850 West 60th Street in Los Angeles. And you can call 888-452-7381. Again, that's 888-452-7381. Please go save a life and don't return them. Thank you.
How nice.
So let me ask you about the Ten Commandments. Except for the first one, there's no mention of God in the remaining nine. What the hell is wrong with having them in classrooms or courtrooms?
Well, again, that's a great question. And that was something that I started struggling with back, I want to say, early 90s. I entered law school in, let's say 1990. And I was fortunate enough to be a witness to the whole Justice Thomas confirmation hearings that Senator Biden headed up. And while I was in law school, I was a little more liberal than I am now. I mean, not much, but I migrated like most people do when they get older. And what I witnessed with Thomas was appalling because it was so hypocritical. You know, had he been a liberal black, they would have been kissing his ring, you know, maybe other parts.
His tuchus.
His tuchus, yeah. Okay, yeah, exactly. But that's when the whole Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse movement really got going in earnest. And I kept thinking to myself, Like, what better place for the Ten Commandments than right in front of a courthouse?
Exactly.
But you have these people who are atheists or are what I would call the First Amendment zealots. You know, in the older days, the liberal believed in free speech, but the separation of church and state was sacrosanct. And what I learned in my studies of history and law, politics and con law, is that there's no such thing as separation of church and state. That is a myth. It's a fraud. It misstates history. It misstates what is in the Constitution. It misstates the jurisprudence by the Supreme Court. And when Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religions, which is what the First Amendment articulates, it just simply means, as most people know practically now, because this stuff is kind of ubiquitous, that Congress and now the states, the state governments, or any government for that matter in America, can't favor one religion over another. In other words, they can't pass a law that says we all have to be Muslim, you know, mm-hmm. or Islam is the favored religion.
Well, they're considering that.
Of course they are. But that's just, again, that's a mind that doesn't know how to think. And these are, and no offense to children, but they're grown-up infants. I mean, they're grown children because they don't know how to think properly. And so what happened was these separation of church and state zealots, and the ACLU is part of it, and the ADL, you know, the Anti-Defamation League, is part of it. They've morphed into a leftist organization that is a purist. It's kind of like the environmentalist movement. They're purists, but they're frauds because, like environmentalists, if you're really into green technology, but you don't think nuclear fission is a good source of energy, then you're a fraud.
Or you have a private plane,
right?
Like certain singer who shall remain anonymous because I don't want bad blood. and she travels all over the place. Good for her. I'm glad that she is successful. But she's using a private plane to go all around the world.
Well, a big private plane, just like the other frauds and hypocrites like Al Gore and everybody else. So these anti-religious, these separation of church and state zealots, as I call them, they, again, let's go back to the meaning question. How do people get meaning? Well, if you're going to destroy a civilization and you're going to try to make it in your own image, that gives you a lot of meaning. So people will go to the courthouses and see these tablets or see these little monuments that are dedicated to the Ten Commandments, and they'll file a lawsuit and they'll get them removed, and it's a big victory for them and they feel good about themselves. I'll give you a great example. You probably remember this. Dennis Prager was involved in this to his credit. The LA County Seal.
They took off the cross.
Was a big seal. I had it on my business cards when I was a DA and a law clerk. I had it on my employee card, and there was a picture of some goddess in the middle that dominated the whole thing. Then there was the Shrine Auditorium, and then there was crops, and there was all this stuff, water, river flowing for the aqueduct or the Mulholland Aqueduct. And there was this tiny little cross above the Shrine Auditorium, and it was a Christian cross. It could have been Catholic, could have been Protestant, or both. Nobody paid attention to that thing, okay, ever. And the anti-religious separation of church and state zealots decided they were going to make it their business to sue the county of L.A. Well, they didn't sue them. They actually threatened to sue them. And three out of the five supervisors caved because they didn't want to spend the money fighting it, right? That's what they said. Zev Yaroslavsky, a Jew, well, he's one of those gynos, honestly. I mean, I don't like to knock people's faith, whatever their faith is, but you know, I don't think he was a practicing Jew, but that may be not here or nor there. But he made a very good, he made a point, and he said it to, I think he might have been on Prager's show, maybe. I don't quote me on that. But I remember he said that, you know, we'd rather just remove it and avoid a multimillion-dollar lawsuit in case we lose. Well, what he didn't tell you, and he didn't tell anybody in the county, was we have 36 courthouses. We have multiple buildings throughout the county that are dedicated for county use, whether it's, you know, fire departments, DA's offices, hospital. I mean, you name it. This is a very at one point, this county had a $26 billion budget a few years ago. It's probably $40 billion for all I know. The state's doubled their budget from $100 to $200 billion in just 10 years. What he didn't tell you was that the cost of changing that seal would have been way more than it would have cost to defend a lawsuit, because there was no guarantee that a court would have actually ordered them to remove it, because it was so de minimis, and you couldn't even figure out what religion they were actually endorsing, if they were endorsing a religion at all. So it's a joke.
I should have told them it was a T.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And so anyways, that's the big fraud. The people, there's also another pathology with these people who are anti-religious, or they get their meaning by destroying stuff or saying, you know, it was my lawsuit that got the cross on this mountain removed, or whatever the case may be. There's also, they don't, you know this, there's, if you have commandments, then, right, you have a commander. And these people don't want to be told what to do. It's funny, they like big, huge government. They don't like a big G, they like a small G, the government. And they love when the government tells everybody what to do and how to do it and control their lives. But this autonomous, anonymous, spiritual God.
Greater being.
Greater being, creator, designer, God. They don't need for that him to tell them not to murder, because they know it's wrong. Ooh, well, you know, that's because their heart is so pure and so good. But I think that's part of it. The part of it is that they don't want to be told what to do by a higher power, okay?
I think you're right.
And so they impose, and again, this is a totalitarian, and it's, they want to impose that on everybody else, you see, because if you want to fix society, because you asked me the question, what is wrong with having the Ten Commandments in a school classroom? Actually, that's a great start to getting our country back on track, right? If a teacher, I mean, how is it that 60 years ago, kids were praying for their teacher and bowing, you know, to the authority of their teacher, and today they smack their teacher, they call the teacher names, and the teachers go home and they have nervous breakdowns, and now they're clinging to their union even more than they ever did, because they, you know, feel like they need help.
And you can't even grade them, and
right,
God forbid, discipline them.
Right.
Because you're going to scar them for life.
Right. So that would be a great start to sort of correcting the ship. But I think those are the reasons why, and of course, the reasons why they don't want the commandments in the school or in the courthouses. And keep in mind also that those voices, even though they may be in the minority, and I'm praying that they are, they're like the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, right?
They're the loudest.
The loudest. The louder they scream, the more they get their way. And also remember, too, Edie, it takes you a lifetime to figure all this stuff out. You know, you listen to other people. You put it in the brain. You know, you put it into the hopper. But there's a big, that's why this whole gender ideology thing is a problem, because people don't have the courage to stand up and say, no, men don't give birth. Men can't menstruate. You know, you want to dress up like a woman, great, do it in the privacy of your own home, but you ain't going to change your sex.
Yeah.
I mean, that's impossible. And now we're finding out it's not only impossible, it's actually pathetic and painful.
Yeah, and you know, you can call yourself whatever you want, but you're not going to make me use bad grammar. If you're a single person, I'm not going to call you they. I may call you it.
Right.
But not they or them, because you're one.
Right, that's not plural, right. Well, but remember, it's cowardice. It really is. It takes courage to stand up and to say these things. If you say these things, people are going to call you a bigot. They're going to call you a hater. And a lot of people just want to live their lives. And we have it good in America for the most part.
Yes.
You know, in various areas of our county here. I was just up in Porter Ranch, and I was talking to someone about this briefly. And I said, look, you know, the political climate nationwide is what it is. But you look around up here and everybody has kind of like a normal upper middle class life, and no one sees any problem. And that's the reason why a lot of these people vote how they vote.
Right. Before we continue, I want to invite you to senior prom. I've been promoting this event, and today is the last day, my friends. Come dance the night away at Senior Prom in support of my dear friend Lisa Gibbons, Lisa's Care Connection. That's tomorrow, September 19th at 7 p.m. Senior Prom is where we get to bring all generations together. Whether you're a student senior or a senior citizen, Senior Prom is your night. Enjoy delicious hors d'oeuvres, drinks, music, and dancing. Tickets start at just $75. It's almost sold out, so you better get your tickets. If you can't afford it, or you can't make it, I'm sorry, if you can't make it, you can make a tax-deductible donation and send a senior citizen to prom. For more information, call 818-847-3686 or visit lisascareconnection.org. Remember, the event is tomorrow, and it's almost sold out, so don't miss out.
Bailar the night away, right?
Yes. I hope you can join us. So let's continue, please, because this is fascinating. So, yeah, people don't want to answer to a higher authority. They think that their heart tells them to be good. Well, some people's heart tells them to be bad.
Right.
And if you don't have a guidance, something bigger than you to tell you this is not right, then you're just going to do it because it feels good. If you're going to listen to your feelings, it feels good to take a Rolex that I didn't pay for, but it, look how nice it looks on me.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't like somebody and you just want to get rid of them, what's going to stop you from just getting rid of them?
Right.
If somebody isn't there to tell you, thou shalt not murder. And murder and kill is different, by the way, like Dennis always says.
Mm-hmm.
I am pro-capital punishment. I'm against murder.
Right.
Huge difference.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, the heart, it's more than the heart, Edie. It takes you a lifetime. And, you know, Dennis has been really expounding on this concept of the conscience, right? Because if you say to somebody, if you don't have a higher power that tells you murder is wrong, how do you know it's wrong? So not everybody says it's the heart or their feeling. They say, well, I have a conscience, right? Well, turns out the conscience is not so stable after all, right? I mean, look at the Nazis. They slept very well at night, apparently.
Right.
And the people that, like you talked about stealing a Rolex, for example, because maybe they feel like they're entitled to it. They took it from somebody who they think is a perpetrator. They're the victim. It's my, you know, or maybe they stole it from a store, right?
People are rich.
Yeah, it's a big corporation. They can, you know, we deserve it now. It's our time. These are our reparations. They can look in the mirror. Their conscience is fine. So the conscience is not a good guide. Neither are their feelings, and neither is their heart. I learned feelings a long time ago because I was raised by a mother who was big on the feminist thing and big on feelings, and she kept talking about her feelings. And one time I said to her, probably was a young boy, I said, your feelings don't matter at all. What are you talking about? And she tried to slap me, and I said, well, no, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm saying that if you feel like, I don't know, someone is being mean to you when they're really not because you don't know what's in their head, how's that justifiable? If you feel the sky is falling when it's not, like Chicken Little, how is that justifiable? I mean, yes, if you put your hand on a hot stove and it burns and you feel pain, that's real, right? But your feelings don't matter. They just don't. They don't matter to the world. Maybe they'll matter to your inner circle, you know, oh, you feel, you know, I'm feeling hurt, I'm feeling down. You know, that's for the nuclear family. It's not for the rest of the world. You know, and that's another pathology that we have in our society is that people emote their feelings, whether it's on social media or out on the streets. You know, you cut someone off and, oh my God, they're now following you and torturing you on the road. It's like, you know, I had, you know, from time to time, people pull over. I'm like, why? Because, you know, you did something. And I'm like, I don't even know you. Like,
yes.
Like, why would I want to, like, in, you know, I have things to do. You know, I got somewhere to go. I got to go to court. I got to go to my office. I got to meet a client. I'm going to whatever. I got to go meet Edie for the podcast. I mean, go live your life. We're all in this together, yes, but you stay in your lane. I stay in mine. If I make a mistake, I'll apologize, you know, if maybe I look down or whatever. But, look, Edie, the pendulum swings, I think. It's like anything. So I've told people all the time that, you know, what's interesting about science or the human condition or geometry or trigonometry is you've got like this sphere, right? It's a circle, 380 degrees. If you cut it in half and you turn it, you get that infamous sine wave, right? Where you're up
right.
in the peak and you come down in the valley. And it's like anything else. It's like your heart rate. It's like the cycle of life or mood, for example. You know, the real moodies, sometimes they're really high, sometimes they're really low. But if you fold it back together, now it's a circle or a sphere. Well, in the macro, right, society level, things move very slowly. I mean, sometimes they can happen rapidly, like the George Floyd riots. You know, the incineration happened immediately and just took hold of the entire country. The pathology just spread like wildfire. You know, and Kamala was out there advocating to bail these people out, just kind of a side political note. But the Leviathan, that's the country, the monolith, it just takes time. And I think what you're seeing is, and I do believe this, I mean, the polling in our country, I think is off. I think the polling is designed to fail. I think it's designed to kind of keep people on their edge. Oh, it's a razor thin margin. Well, not if you talk to people. Right. 78%, almost 80% of the country thinks we're on the wrong economic track. You know, you're from Mexico, right? But you came here legally to this country, as did many people from Europe and Asia and Africa, and everybody loves these people, right? So this whole xenophobic trope is baloney. But we've got an evasion, not only at the border, but in the skies. We got the Biden administration flying people from other countries to different parts of the country. And so on those two issues alone, besides foreign policy, okay, I mean, really, those are the three pillars. That's the three-legged stool. You talk to people, and they just are beside themselves. I mean, I never thought immigration was a problem when Donald Trump was talking about it in 2015 and 2016. I thought it was the biggest joke. Yes, we've got some people coming over illegally, but we got a wall, and it's been orderly. But today, it is a madhouse.
Well, this conversation is fascinating, and we have to continue it. But we're coming to the end of the show. So I want to thank you, Todd, for so graciously accepting my invitation to come to the show. We got to do this again. You have to promise to come back.
Well, as they say in Espanol, mucho gusto, right?
So thank you for tuning in.
My pleasure.
I'm Edie J. Adler, and remember to always, always be grateful.
You're listening to The Edie J. Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.